The Shepherd Study, helping pastors discover literature to broaden their ministries. This week, we look at Reading Isaiah, Poetry and Vision by Peter D. Quinn Miskell. Our reviewer this week is Pastor Steve Bauer. Peter D. Quinn Miskell is an adjunct faculty member at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver and the Aquinas Institute of St. Louis. One has to admire the transparency with which Quinn Miskell begins his book. He openly admits that his book is not an in-depth commentary. Instead, his focus is to provide a, quote, new way of reading Isaiah, end quote. This new way seeks to reveal, quote, the richness, intricacy, and complexity of Isaiah, end quote. He explores the, quote, variety of poetic devices, themes, and imagery, end quote, within the book. He sets forth that Isaiah must be taken as a whole and not divided up into two or more parts. He also concludes that the book was written about a, quote, 5th or even 4th century BCE date, end quote. Quinn Miskell highlights the literary features that he will be emphasizing throughout the rest of the book: simile, metaphor, apostrophe, personification, synecdoche, and narrative or speeches. The book is divided into 5 chapters, 4 of which are labeled with questions. Chapter 1, what is the book of Isaiah? Chapter 2, what does Isaiah think? Chapter 3, what does Isaiah imagine? Chapter 4, who speaks and who acts in Isaiah? Chapter 5, the Lord's Holy Mountain. He makes it clear from the outset, quote, I want to guide my readers in a way of reading this grand poem and vision and leave it to them to develop their own theological and spiritual conclusions and applications, end quote. He asks more questions than he answers, and that seems to be his intent. There is some difficulty in evaluating this book. One reason is that Quinn Miskell seems to go out of his way to avoid any category into which one might put his book. It's not exegetical, though it does contain evidence of exegesis. It's not narrative and literary, but does contain narrative elements. It's not a theological treatise, but does contain theological assertions. In this evaluation, I will proceed in 2 ways. First, I will evaluate him by the criteria he sets up in his book. Second, I will evaluate him by the unintended categories he sets up for himself. In the first category, he is largely successful. In a dizzying array of diversity, he abundantly shows the complex and contrasting nature of the book of Isaiah. In the second category, he is largely unsuccessful. He introduces the literary features on page 13, simile, metaphor, apostrophe, personification, and synecdoche, but these get only a passing reference throughout the rest of the book. He gives examples of most of these, but he doesn't give the importance of these examples. Or, to word it differently, he tells us the what with these examples, but he doesn't tell us the so what with them. His unintended categories are also worth noting. While Quinn Miskell seeks to extricate himself from any sort of critique or judgment by stating that he is not trying to make any waves in the areas of translation and theology, he does make assertions in both areas. And when he does this as a professor in a school of theology, these assertions deserve scrutiny. I will limit my critique to the following 2 areas: translation and theology. Quinn Miskell's translation of some key passages in Isaiah are linguistically possible, yet they are exegetically and contextually not probable. One example is his translation of Isaiah chapter 34, verse 14. Demons meet with phantoms, and a hairy beast calls to his friend. Indeed, there Lilith, a female demon, reposes and finds rest for herself. He takes desert dwellers, tziyim, to mean demons. This is also how the Septuagint takes this difficult passage. Kai synantesuse daimonia anakintauros. The real issue, though, is Lilith, Lilith. The word here is a hapax legomena, and taking it as a female demon is going beyond Isaiah and into legend. The explanation from New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis is probably the best. Quote, it is likely that Lilith, was an actual desert animal, a bat or owl, who was animistically endowed with demonic qualities by superstitious pagan worshippers. Isaiah's reference, however, does not make Lilith the object of worship. Rather, the term is used to symbolize the forthcoming desolation of judgment, end quote. Quinn Miskell's translation is improbable for Isaiah chapter 34, verse 14, but his translation and the theology it brings for another passage, Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7, is untenable. He translates the verse, quote, "I make peace and I create evil," end quote. Then he writes, quote, "I create evil" is a shocking statement that is usually softened in translations, end quote. We might argue that all the translations except Quinn Miskell and the KJV accurately reflect the use of the word in context. The word ra doesn't always carry with it moral implications. This might be one of his examples which he intentionally leaves hanging so that we make our own theological conclusions. That being said, his reasoning is unsettling. There are other examples of Quinn Miskell's tendency to go in his own direction theologically. I'll conclude with one example from Isaiah chapter 53. Concerning the great servant song, he writes, quote, "It has received large amounts of attention over the years. Not so the song of the woman in chapter 54. This certainly reflects, in part, the fact that most commentators have been men with a decided male focus. I want to join efforts to counter this heavy male focus," end quote. This is an unproved assertion. Not only this, but it is an ad hominem unproved assertion. What then is the great servant song speaking about in Isaiah chapter 53, verses 1 through 6? This is his assessment. Quote, "Because of the references to this Isaianic text in the Gospels, a long-standing Christian interpretation of Isaiah puts this poem in a Christological context, reads the servant as Christ, and sees this as a process of vicarious suffering and atonement. That is, that through his, the servant's own unmerited suffering, he enables others to escape the divine punishment that they deserved. In Isaiah, people are punished and suffer for their own iniquity. A large portion of Isaiah's vision declares that the iniquity has been forgiven and that the time of desolation is over or soon to be over. In Isaiah and the rest of the Hebrew Bible, there is no hint that God will accept the suffering of the innocent and righteous in place of the punishment of the guilty and wicked. People may well suffer unjustly or excessively. Jerusalem has received from the Lord's hand double for all their sins, but not in place of the deserved punishment of others," end quote. There is a brutal irony in his words here. Lilith can be taken from mythology and put in his translation. Even a Canaanite version of creation can be set alongside the Genesis account with equal veracity. But in the discussion of the meaning of Isaiah chapter 53, verses 1 through 6, he allows no room for the New Testament to speak. Even if what he claims about the rest of Isaiah were true, i.e., quote, "there is no hint that God will accept the suffering of the innocent in place of the punishment of the guilty," end quote, that would not eliminate the reality of what Isaiah 53 actually says. Quinn Miskell is successful in his goal of showing us the contrasts in Isaiah's words. His perspective, which seeks to read Isaiah as a unit, is a welcome addition to studies of this book. He is unsuccessful, however, in his other goals of showing us the beauty and literary value of Isaiah's poetry. When we add to this the translation excesses and theological uncertainties, it is difficult to recommend this book to either pastors or parishioners.